What would it cost society and business to reduce climate change by cutting greenhouse gas emissions? Will it harm our economy if we just go on with business as usual? How much? These questions are addressed in this lecture by Lord Adair Turner in Britain. Given February 7, 2007, Turner explains the logic of the Stern Report, just issued by Sir Nicholas Stern on behalf of the UK government. The Stern Report predicts it would cost about 1% of the world's production to modify our energy, forestry, and agricultural systems toward a low-carbon state. Just leaving things as they are, with ever-rising greenhouse gases, would strip 5 to 20% from our wealth, Stern says. Adair Turner is a businessman and advisor to the Blair government. He has been Director General of the Confederation of British Industry, a lobby group, and he organized the Sustainable Development Commission. This speech, The Economics of Climate Change, was presented at Savoy Place in London. The first half of the one-hour speech investigates the prospects and costs of mitigating emissions of greenhouse gases. It contains a game plan that can be understood by anyone. The second part is more difficult, analyzing the economic techniques used by Stern to estimate the cost of climate-induced damage. Turner addresses three criticisms of Stern's calculations from other economists. It helps to understand the term discount rate ahead of time, so the last part of the speech will be clearer to those with a background in either business or economics. Still, it is important to join the struggle to understand how difficult it is to measure such imponderables as the economic value of losing tens of thousands of species, or dislocation of millions of people, horrors difficult to measure out in pounds, euros, or dollars. A video of the speech has been available online, and both parts are available for free download from the climate menu of www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Here is the speech by Jonathan Adair Turner. This is part one of two.
My name is Jonathan Porritt. I'm the chairman of the Sustainable Development Commission. Welcome this evening and congratulations for making it, despite the BBC's really dire, stroke apocalyptic warnings of this nation being engulfed in what seems to me to be a perfectly seasonable, reasonable weather event. And isn't it nice that something's actually more or less on track in terms of the weather? And yet what happens? The country decides to close itself down. So I'm sorry to say we have people ringing up all afternoon at the horror of a snowstorm, and hence, I'm afraid, slightly fewer of us here this evening than we'd planned. Unless, of course, that is an excuse for the fact they're all staying at home watching the football, which is just not an excuse at all. But we are really delighted to welcome you here this evening. Delighted to welcome Adair Turner to give this lecture this evening. This is obviously an extremely timely moment for interventions of this kind in the debate, and I'm very much hoping that this evening we'll have plenty of opportunities to explore some of the angles that Adair is going to share with us. When he and I agreed on the date, I don't think we really knew quite that we were just coming within 4 or 5 days of the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So that makes it pretty topical. I think we probably both hoped that we would, by this stage, have seen an acceleration in the pace of interest around climate change following on from the Stern Review. And that, of course, we've seen over the last 2 or 3 months, an enormous upsurge in different organizations in the public sector and private sector beginning to show more and more concern for interest in anything at all relating to climate change, and a lot of leadership propositions coming forward from a number of different sources. And we've got a wonderful competition, of course, going in the private sector, in the retail area in particular, which is very encouraging. A lot of people, therefore, are talking about one of these elusive tipping points. I've offered people so many tipping points in 30 years that I'm extremely nervous to offer you another one now. Having ground my way through the fourth assessment report, the only tipping point that stayed with me after that was the tipping point that Jim Lovelock has been trying to share with us for some time, namely the point at which the human species loses the ability to command its own destiny. It is quite a telling moment in the history of humankind. For Jim Lovelock, of course, he thinks the moment has probably already come and gone. For others, it seems to be very imminent. And if we actually read through in detail what the Fourth Assessment Report is offering us by way of these projections for temperature increases, the minimum being 1.8 degrees centigrade, that's as close to the 2 degrees centigrade which we thought would be the maximum that we could allow for during the course of this century. So this tipping point is a difficult concept to pin down. I've no doubt that Adair will be sharing with us this evening some of his own thoughts about that, and particularly, of course, some of his own thoughts about the Stern report and the ways in which that report is now being mediated, handled, discussed around the world in different ways, which is a very interesting issue in its own right. So for us, this international context is enormously important. There's a vast new surge of energy coming into issues around things like how do we agree on a stabilisation target, which is obviously critical. But we are very focused here in the UK on what now needs to be done. And whilst we obviously welcome the success of the UK government in terms of reaching its Kyoto target, which we believe they are still on track for, happily, we are, of course, very worried at some of the areas of falling short that are now all too palpably present in the midst of this government's tenure of office. We ourselves will shortly be publishing the Sustainable Development in Government report, which I'm sorry to say is not particularly reassuring about the notion of government taking a leadership role to demonstrate to the rest of the public sector and indeed to the private sector what needs to be done in that area. And of course, shortly we're expecting a report from the NAO, the National Audit Office, on sustainable buildings on the government of state, which gives an equally gloomy summary of the degree to which the government is falling short on its own aspirations in that area. So clearly, even here in the UK, it is time for some radically different thinking of different sorts, different thinking about the structure of government. And we are amongst those persuaded now that the separation of primary responsibility for energy policy between two government departments is no longer tenable and that it needs to be brought together in one department. New thinking about our regulatory systems. The Sustainable Development Commission is in the middle of a very detailed review of Ofgem and the ways in which it is interpreting its sustainable development duty. And I don't think I'm giving away any secrets if I say that we believe there need to be quite profound changes in the way in which Ofgem interprets its role now, several years on from the point at which it was created primarily as an economic regulator in a newly liberalised market. That isn't sufficient any longer. It doesn't do the job as we try and make sense of these interconnected objectives for energy policy in the UK. And, of course, new thinking about energy networks and how we steer the billions of pounds of new investment in energy networks here in the UK to ensure that they are delivering the outcomes we require by 2050. So for the Sustainable Development Commission, this is a hugely important area of concern, as it is for practically every organisation in the UK. When we were thinking of ways in which we could mark the significance of that, we agreed amongst ourselves that Adair would be a wonderful person to have as our lecturer this evening. I've known Adair for many years, and happily we sat together as trustees of WWF for many a long year, and it was during the course of that shared experience that Adair presented what I still think is one of the most astonishing pieces of work I've ever seen on the issue of pensions, population, and the environment, which is still for me a benchmark in terms of trying to shed new light on extremely controversial and difficult areas. So I very much hope that you will welcome Adair Turner to our midst this evening, and we much look forward to hearing what you have to say. Adair.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, the scientific fact of climate change is now largely accepted. I think the percentage of respected climate scientists who deny that global warming is occurring and is man-made is now minute. It's about as small as the percentage of people who, by, say, 1990, believed that there was no link between tobacco and lung cancer. And that reflects the compelling evidence. We know that the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which over the half million or so years until the start of the Industrial Revolution oscillated in a range between about 180 and 300 parts per million, has now shot up from that long-term trend, has reached about 440, and is increasing at about 2 parts per year. We know that even if we do take action now, quite radical action, to reduce emissions, it would be extremely difficult to stabilise concentrations below, say, 550 parts per million, which is about twice the pre-industrial level. And we know that greenhouse gases warm the Earth. The correlation of greenhouse gases there, the concentrations of greenhouse gases, and the temperature over that last half million period is really startlingly clear. So we are conducting an enormous chemical experiment which is almost certain to raise the Earth's temperature significantly, and that temperature increase is already occurring. So the key question is no longer, is global warming occurring, but what are we going to do about it? And since the causes of the warming are economic, the progress of material prosperity, so must the solutions be built on sound economics. So the topic this evening is the economics of climate change, but in talking to that topic, I suffer from a major disadvantage, which is I am not Nick Stern. I am merely tonight, for you, a sort of papal nuncio sent by the Pope himself. Nick has written a superb review combining detailed analysis of economic theory with balanced judgments on the way forward. And I could just put up some summary slides of his conclusions and urge you all to read the book, which I do urge you to do. But the Stern Review has not put an end to the debate. Some eminent economists have questioned some of the review's assumptions, and some rather less eminent ones have attacked it roundly. And those attacks have received significant publicity. A prominent op-ed piece in the Daily Telegraph warned of another dodgy dossier, which, according to Charles Moore, not previously known as a major expert on the economics of climate change, was as alarmist and unfounded as the one on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And alongside the intellectual counterattack, the more mundane process of special interest lobbying continues. Angela Merkel's speech to the Davos World Economic Forum 2 weeks ago promised that Germany would provide leadership on climate change in the G8 and European Union, but that hasn't stopped German car manufacturers arguing, I fear perhaps successfully, against the correct tightening of European auto emission standards that we need. The economic case for significant and early action on climate has been pushed forward enormously by Nick Stern's report, but will have to be continually made and restated. So tonight, I'm going to focus on two sets of arguments which economists have presented against action on climate change. First, the criticisms of the Stern report. Second, the case presented in what was called the Copenhagen Consensus Project, which was organized by Bjorn Lomborg. Together, those arguments make the following case. They say that even if the majority view of climate change scientists, as expressed in the IPCC assessments, is correct, sound economics suggests that we should take action later rather than sooner, and sound ethics suggests spending our money on more pressing problems such as AIDS, malaria, or malnutrition. And it's these assertions I'll assess tonight. And in doing so, I'll also comment on the role that good economics, which I think when it is good economics is the not-so-dismal science, the role that good economics should play in our decision-making. Now, in order to do that, I am going to have to talk about economics. So this evening does come with a sort of viewer warning. Although there will be no sexually explicit content, nor obscene language, there will be a few equations and even some members of the Greek alphabet. Those of a nervous disposition who can't deal with that may have to cover their eyes at that point. Now, Stern's overall conclusion is that if we do not act, the overall costs and risks of climate change will be equivalent to losing at least 5% of global GDP each year, now and forever. If a wider range of risks and impacts is taken into account, the estimate of damage could rise to 20% or more. While in contrast, the costs of action, reducing greenhouse gas emissions to avoid the worst impact of climate change, can be limited to around 1% of global GDP each year. It's this summary assessment which has unleashed controversy in the economics profession. Professor William Nordhaus has accused Stern of failing to present a balanced picture. Professor Partha Dasgupta believes that, I quote, parameter values have been chosen to yield desired results, which in economic parlance is a really brutal thing to say about someone. While Professor Richard Toll, though he is quoted approvingly by Stern at several points in his review, has actually gone completely ballistic. If a student of mine had handed in this report as a master's thesis, Toll says, if I were in a good mood, I would give him a D for diligence, but more likely I would give him an F for fail. Though I have to say that when you look at all Toll's comments, they are so dramatically internally inconsistent between one paragraph and the next that it is difficult to take that attack seriously. But certainly the debate has been joined. Seminars are being held, commentaries are being written and posted on the internet. There is an entire blog universe to do with the discount rate. And the deadliest weapons in the academic armory, which are the footnote and the rebuttal of other people's footnotes through your own footnote, have been extensively deployed. Despite the noise of battle, however, the debate is essentially one about degree rather than principle. All the economists involved accept that climate change is occurring and could have harmful consequences. All accept that emissions should sometime be cut. Nordhaus, for instance, talks about a ramp-up of climate change policy with modest reductions in the near term, followed by sharp reductions in the medium and long term. But though the differences are of degree rather than principle, they are still profound. While Stern believes that we should cut emissions by something like 90% versus a business-as-usual projection by 2100, Nordhaus suggests that the optimal cut versus the business-as-usual scenario is only about 25%. In principle, the key question to which climate change economics should provide the answer in terms of what we do rather than how we do it, and I'm going to mainly talk about what we do today, is as follows. We want to compare the economic and social costs of climate change, the costs of mitigating climate change, and the costs of adapting to climate change. And we wish to compare all alternative future emission paths to find the one which maximises the net present value of human welfare, given the changing pattern of costs through time, and using appropriate discount rates to compare the value of different people's welfare at different points in time. Now, in principle, this is simple. This is the sort of stuff that economists just love doing. In practice, it is mind-bogglingly difficult calculation, and one which, as we shall see, requires not only computational complexity, but conceptual difficulty and inherently subjective judgments. But the complexity and subjectivity relate almost entirely to the costs of adverse consequences and adaptation, much less to the costs of mitigation. Because the striking agreed fact in all this debate, in the complex economics of climate change, is that the costs of mitigation are surprisingly small. The Stern Review investigates the possible costs of a policy designed to limit concentrations of all greenhouse gases to a maximum of about 550 parts per million, which is equivalent to a CO2 element of somewhere about 480 to 490 parts per million. That would probably still imply a temperature increase of, say, 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, so about 2.3 against the present level, which would be up against what we might think the tipping point might be, but it would greatly reduce the risk of significantly higher increases. It would require that emissions were set on something like this trajectory, peaking around 2020 to 25, down 25% against today's global level by 2050, and eventually down 80% below present levels, and even more, something like 90% against business as usual. Given the inevitable growth of per capita emissions in China and India towards developed country levels, this would require rich countries like the UK to cut emissions by something like 60% from current levels by 2050. But the Stern Review's best estimate of the global cost of this path is about 1% of global GDP. And previous estimates for the UK suggest that the cost of cutting our emissions by 60% by 2050 would be something like 0.3 to 2% of GDP in that year, let's say 1% as a mid-estimate, which would mean that rather than UK GDP growing at, say, 2% per annum from now to 2050, it might grow at 1.98% per annum, opening up the huge gap in prosperity that you can see on this slide between the firm line and the dotted line, though it's possible that those of you at the back of the hall can't see that there are two lines there at all. GDP in 2050 would be just 1% or so below what it would otherwise be, and prosperity would reach in about July 2050 the level it would otherwise have reached in January, a level about 2 to 2.5 times the current. And the estimates for the US are of similar magnitude, which doesn't exactly sound to me like a threat to the American way of life. And what's interesting is that while in the economic profession there's a lively debate about whether we should accept even those small costs, there is close to unanimity that the costs of achieving emission cuts are small. This is a bit of the debate where the pessimists say that it might be 3 or 4% rather than 1%. But nobody says that it will be 10 or 15 or 20%. So why is that unanimity? Cutting carbon emissions can be achieved in many different ways. Some of these involve no adverse impact on economic growth. Some might have adverse impact, but only quite a small one. And the range of estimated costs from a fraction of 1% to a few percentage points reflects the fact that we don't know what the mix of zero cost and small cost actions will be. But we do know that whatever the mix, the maximum cost cannot be large, because even the most costly actions are not that costly. Think about three ways of cutting carbon emissions: changes in lifestyle, improvements in energy efficiency, and deriving our energy from non-carbon emitting sources. The first category, minor changes in lifestyle, involves no cost to GDP at all. If people can be persuaded to buy more fuel-efficient cars, what happens is that they spend less money on cars and have more to spend on other less carbon-emitting forms of consumption, while GDP and GDP growth don't change one iota. And if they are persuaded to do that by increased taxation on petrol, offset by lower taxes on other consumption items, GDP growth doesn't change one iota. If American air conditioning was set 1 or 2 degrees higher, and people spent the money saved on other categories of consumption, American GDP growth doesn't fall by even the smallest fraction of a percent. And there would, of course, be a lot of happier foreign visitors, no longer bewildered by the idea that you should spend money to send such a blast of cold air down on you that we need to dress more warmly in an office in Atlanta in the summer than we would dream of dressing in our office in London in the winter. In rich, developed societies, we face multiple opportunities to adapt our behaviour in ways which cut emissions significantly, but which make only very minor differences to our overall lifestyle. We are also faced with numerous opportunities in households and in companies to use more energy-efficient technologies in ways which cost us nothing and which don't even require any changes in end lifestyle. Setting the air conditioning a few degrees warmer requires a very minor adjustment in the end lifestyle, in what is the end consumption, a slightly warmer environment. But, and at this stage, I'm afraid I've forgotten my props, which are sitting outside. But I'm an economist, and therefore I can say, imagine two light bulbs. And what I'm going to say is that using this light bulb, rather than this light bulb, changes lifestyle not at all. Because they both produce the same amount of light, but this one, which you can clearly see in my hand, is a 12-watt bulb, and this one a 60-watt bulb, an 80% cut in emissions for the same end benefit. And if you buy this light bulb, over a 5-year period, the light bulbs and the electricity used cost you 10% less than if you used the 60-watt light bulb, and so that your material prosperity, measured in your ability to spend more money on other items of consumption, actually goes up. Households face many such opportunities, and throughout the economy, companies too are sitting on huge opportunities to save energy through the redesign of processes in ways which simultaneously cut emissions and give positive returns, if only they make energy saving a key focus of management attention. In the UK, work by the Carbon Trust suggests that Britain could cut carbon emissions by at least 10% in ways which, far from costing money, actually save money and are positive MPV projects, and which therefore, far from cutting the growth rate, would actually increase it. So by minor changes in lifestyle and through energy efficiency improvement, we can go a long way to cut emissions at minimal or indeed nil economic cost, and to cut emissions even if our energy comes from the same mix of sources as today. But the third category of change is to change the energy source, either to renewable sources, wind power, solar, biofuels, or to fossil fuels used in a non-carbon emitting fashion, capturing the CO2 at the power station outlet and storing it by injecting it into geological structures, carbon capture and storage. And it's this third route which is most likely to result in some cut to GDP and to the growth of GDP, because low carbon energy sources are likely to be more expensive than carbon emitting sources, but not that much more expensive, and in some cases, no more expensive at all. At current oil, coal and gas prices, and certainly at the gas prices which existed in spring last year, onshore wind farms are in the UK close to competitive with fossil fuels as a source of electricity. They hardly need a subsidy. Indeed, if gas prices had stayed where they were last spring, the subsidy regime for onshore wind would have been a license to print money. And we can probably get up to 20% of our electricity from wind at minimal cost to GDP. Biofuels, biodiesel and bioethanol are still more expensive than fossil fuel-based diesel and gasoline, but at present oil prices, they are something like 10 to 50% more expensive, not twice or three times as much. Solar photovoltaic energy is currently much more expensive than fossil fuel-based electricity, but much more expensive means 3 to 4 times more expensive, not 10 times more expensive, and that 3 to 4 times will come down. So that the reason why economists are close to unanimous that the total cost of radical emission cuts will be at most only a few percentage points of GDP is the following simple but absolutely robust mathematical logic. A developed, rich economy, such as Britain or America, spends about 4 to 5% of its GDP on energy inputs. By 2050, that percentage will probably be only about 2 to 3%, simply because even under business as usual, we steadily improve the energy efficiency of our economy. So suppose that in order to reduce CO2 emissions by 60%, we have to pay 50% more per unit for all our energy than we do today, then the economic cost of doing that is 50% of 2 to 3%, which is 1 to 1.5%. Sometimes the crucial insights in economics do not rely on complex models or complex theory, but on order of magnitude calculations and common sense. The total cost of radically reducing our emissions will depend on the mix of different types of action by which we reduce emissions, but even in the worst case, is going to be only a few percentage points of GDP, a delay of a year, say, in getting to the date at which we've increased our material standard of living 2 or 2.5 times. So whatever the debate about whether we should cut emissions and how fast, the fact that it is possible over a 50-year time frame to cut them radically at low cost is absolutely clear.
That ends part one of a speech by Lord Adair Turner called That ends part one of the speech, The Economics of Climate Change, by Lord Adair Turner, given February 7, 2007, at Savoy Place in London. You can hear part two as a download from www.ecoshock.org.